From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Think that pirates are a thing of the past? Well, think again, me bucko. Although the colorful costumes and language may have been buried in Davy Jones' locker, there are still pirates roaming the oceans, and they're armed with automatic weapons and rocket launchers. On today's show, we'll look at modern piracy, and we'll learn why one of the most famous pirates of olden days may not have been a pirate at all.
I couldn't believe Captain Kidd was a man who basically tried to go straight, tried to be a war hero, and it all backfired, and the man who embraced the criminal life walks away with the treasure. I just was stunned.
Also, some not-so-famous female buccaneers. And digital piracy, downloading music from the internet.
Yo-ho, yo-ho, a pirate's life for me. We pillage, we plunder, we rifle and loot. Drink up, me hearties, yo-ho. We kidnap and ravage and don't give a hoot. Drink up, me hearties, yo-ho. Yo-ho, yo-ho, a pirate's life for me. We extort, we pilfer, we filch and sack. Drink up, me hearties, yo-ho. Maraud and embezzle and even hijack. Drink up, me hearties, yo-ho. Yo-ho, yo-ho, a pirate's life for me. We kindle and char and play.
That's the theme song from the popular Disney theme park attraction, Pirates of the Caribbean. And the Pirates of the Caribbean will be sailing their way to a movie theater near you next summer. That's right, Disney's turning the ride into a film. Now, you might think of Captain William Kidd as a pirate of the Caribbean, but it seems that Captain Kidd was actually a privateer of the Caribbean. A privateer is someone who hunts down pirates. This is the argument that Richard Zax makes in his book The Pirate Hunter, The True Story of Captain Kidd, and Zax is not the first person to make this claim. He has uncovered a lot of evidence that strengthens the case. According to Zax, William Kidd was the victim of 17th-century English politics.
It really was a plot, and it's, you know, I don't know how much you want to get into of English politics at the time, but there were Whigs and there were Tories, and the Kidd's backers were all Whigs. And the Tory party, when the rumors started that Kidd had turned pirate, the Tory party was so excited. We're going to take this guy. We're going to get him to admit that he was hired by these Whig lords to be a pirate, and we're going to basically throw these guys out of office, if not execute them for being traitors. I mean, the idea of a royal commission given to a pirate is just totally unthinkable. And unfortunately for the Tories, Kidd was an honorable man. He refused to say that he was hired to be a pirate because he wasn't hired to be a pirate. And the Whigs decided the easiest way to get rid of him was just to have him executed for piracy and say, oh, my God, we didn't expect this at all.
So what was he hired to do?
He was hired to chase pirates and to bring back their treasure. And the sleazy part about his commission, and this part was secret, was that he would not have to bring the treasure to the Admiralty courts, which was the standard procedure for a privateer. He would bring it directly to his backers. These were four of the most powerful men in England. One man held the title of governor of New York, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. He was another one of Kidd's backers. And basically, Kidd would bring it to this governor, and they would just divide it among themselves, no questions asked. It's sort of like getting a commission to tackle jewel thieves right outside Tiffany's, and you get to keep the jewels. I mean, it was probably an illegal commission. And the House of Commons actually discussed whether the original commission was illegal. And they debated 12 straight hours and then finally decided by four votes that it wasn't illegal.
Now, Kidd's wife was the wealthiest widow in New York. She owned 38 acres in Manhattan. Obviously, Kidd didn't need to chase pirates. Why'd he do it? The spirit of adventure?
Some of it was that his wife had begged him to be a merchant captain after they got married. He had been, you know, basically a privateer and a tough guy. And she begged him to be a merchant captain, and he did it for 4 years. He ferried, you know, cloth and sugar and all these kind of things up and down from the Caribbean to New York to London. And after 4 years, he just couldn't take it anymore. He wanted action again. It was still the war against the French, and he wanted to get a post as captain fighting the French. But he couldn't get, you know, he didn't have connections in England. He couldn't get that job. But this privateer opportunity opened up. And Kidd claims he didn't even want it. He claims he turned it down at first.
But there does seem to be a kind of a piratical theme running through William Kidd, whether he was a pirate or not. He wanted the spirit of adventure.
Oh, he did. He clearly, and he was such a tough captain. I mean, it's kind of interesting that he had such a reputation for being a hard-ass captain that he needed to sign up 150 men to go on this pirate hunting mission. He couldn't get a crew because he had such a reputation for being difficult until he changed. They had a thing called the articles, the ship's articles, which were basically agreement between the labor agreement between the crew and the captain. until he changed that to state that the captain couldn't punish any crew member without a majority vote of the crew.
What kind of organization is that?
Well, it's kind of like a municipal union, I think, you know, modern days. But it's basically like, unless you went, you couldn't punish. I mean, here's a captain who's got to get 150 men to man the cannons and the sails and the rest of it, and he couldn't punish anyone. So he had such, to me, reckless courage to go out on this mission with, and he even knew that a dozen of his crewmen were former pirates, and he still went out. He thought he was that tough that he could pull this off. And it didn't quite work out that way.
Were they to be well paid in addition to this, or was it all dependent on what they managed to steal back from the pirates?
Well, the slang expression was no prey, no pay. So they had no monthly wages. They basically would get to keep a one-part share, like 150th of the total take. But kind of like Hollywood accounting, they had to pay their expenses back. They had to pay for their own food. And this Captain Kidd is determining how much he had spent on their food, and they had to pay for their weapons. And they had to... So it was just a recipe for disaster. It was pretty standard formula, but it was still, and after a year, they hadn't captured a ship. So these men had known they'd worked the sails and done everything for a full year for no wages.
So when did they leave? They left from New York in what, 1696?
Exactly.
And they headed where?
They headed east across the Atlantic, then south around the tip of Africa, and then up to Madagascar. The idea was the Caribbean was kind of fished out for pirates. And there were too many royal navies floating around fighting battles. It was too risky. The pirates had now switched their activities to the Indies, where they found they could get these Muslim ships that often didn't even fight back. And they were fabulously wealthy. So the pirates were in the Indies, so that's where a pirate hunter would go. So Kidd headed to the Indies and reached there in 1697.
Of course, if he'd been a real pirate, he could have attacked any shipping that he came across, but he had to wait until he found pirates, and that must have put some limitations on what he could accomplish.
Well, it did, and this is the heart of my argument, is the Kidd accosted four or five ships that were English and Dutch and other neutrals, Portuguese, and he actually fought his crew down. He fought down mutinies to stop them from attacking the other ships, and they voted, two-thirds majority vote, to attack an English ship at one point, and Kidd fought them down. And at one point, while he was drinking with the captain of another ship below deck, he realized these ships can't just lash side by side. They crash into each other. So there may be 100 yards separating the ship. His men rowed a little boat over there and started taking things from the other ship. When Kidd found out, he forced them to give the goods back. Now, at his trial, this was counted as piracy, that he had taken these goods, when actually, if you check the records, he had forced his men to give almost everything back.
And one of the other major figures in your book is Robert Culliford. Where did he come from?
I was so thrilled to discover Culliford. I mean, Culliford had only been written about maybe two pages in all of history, and I gave him about a third of the book. He was out of East Lou in Cornwall, and he and Kidd had been together in the early days down in the Caribbean, and they had stolen a French privateer ship and taken it over to the English to fight in the war on the side of England against France. And they were heroes, basically. But then about 3 months later, Culliford made a huge decision. He was sick of being some kind of patriot and making no money. And he stole that ship, the Blessed William, from Captain Kidd. And so Culliford decided in 1690 to be a pirate. And Kidd decided to be an honorable government, privateer. And unbelievably, 8 years later, Kidd and Culliford meet again. And Culliford is the captain of the biggest, meanest pirate ship in the Indies. And Kidd is the pirate hunter with two ships in tow. Kidd wants to attack Culliford.
And did he then? I mean, did they come to blows?
He ordered his men to attack, and one sailor shouted, "I'd rather fire two guns into you than one into Culliford." And another man shouted, 10 guns into you." And 96 of his crew of 115 mutinied over to Robert Culliford. It was the second time Kidd had lost to Culliford. It was just devastating, because this was a chance to be a real hero. Culliford was the notorious pirate. Kidd would have had... They probably would have forgiven everything. He would have had the two ships with French passes. He would have had the pirate ship. He would have had the pirates. And his men turned pirate. And that's part of the reason Kidd got labeled a pirate, because 95 of the men who had signed up with Captain Kidd clearly turned pirate.
Now, what happened to the other 55? Did Kidd stay on board the Adventure with them and try to tough it out?
By then, he only had 115. So he had about 20 men left to him. And yes, Culliford sailed out and was, as typical Culliford, amazingly successful. The first thing he captures is a French ship with 10 tons of brandy on board. And they have a drunken party, and then they go on and capture make one of the richest captures in the history of the Indies. But Kidd is basically left in Ile Sainte-Marie, Madagascar, with this 15, 20 men, and a huge wrecked ship to try and sail back. And he succeeded somehow in hiding quite a bit of the treasure from the pirates. Either he hid it on land or he did something. We're not exactly sure how he succeeded, but he definitely had this treasure. And he got a crewman here and a man there, and he actually sailed the ship back with this skeleton crew. He sailed it back to the Caribbean, and he went right to an English island, which shows that he didn't fear the English. He thought he had done something heroic.
Which also shows that he wasn't as smart as he thought he was, because that proved to be a big mistake.
Well, when he went there and he discovered that a pardon had been issued to basically all the English pirates in the world except for two men, Captain Avery and Captain Kidd, and he was just stunned. I mean, he thought he had moved heaven and earth to bring back, you know, arguably like 20,000-30,000 pounds, you know, British pounds worth of treasure. And here he's this most wanted criminal in the English Empire, and he needed to buy time. So he went to St. Thomas, which was then Danish, and tried to buy some time. And the Danish were afraid of the English. They wouldn't help him. And then basically he had to sell a lot of his goods in order to travel. His crew started leaving him to travel in a smaller ship and come. He had a big decision. Do I go back north and see my wife and daughter and talk to the governor, or do I disappear with all this treasure? And obviously any pirate would disappear. He had a huge treasure. But he decided to come north, and he sailed north on a small ship, the San Antonio, and rendezvoused with his wife off Block Island and eventually agreed to meet with the governor in Boston. And that was, again, a big mistake.
Now, in the meantime, what was happening with Culliford? Here's a man. Was he pardoned?
Well, in the very end, the irony is that Kidd gets arrested. Kidd gets shipped over to Newgate Prison. And then Culliford, who, you know, goes on to have another half year of great success as a pirate, gets the pardon document and comes back to London thinking this document will protect him. And it does for a while, but then he gets thrown in Newgate Prison, too. And the two of them are in prison at the same time and at Captain Kidd's trial. When Kidd is convicted on some very flimsy testimony by characters who perjured themselves, Kidd's sentenced to die. And the very next item of business for the court is the pardoning of Robert Culliford. And Kidd had to watch that.
Richard Zax is the author of The Pirate Hunter, The True Story of Captain Kidd. Zax says that folk songs deserve a lot of the blame for painting Captain Kidd as a bloodthirsty pirate. Here's part of one song that gets it wrong, or gets it right, if you're still not convinced.
My name is William Kidd, as I sailed, my name is William Kidd, as I sailed. My name is William Kidd, God's laws I did forbid, and most wickedly I did, as I sailed. My parents taught me well, as I sailed, my parents taught me well, as I sailed. My parents taught me well, to shun the gates of hell, but still I did rebel, as I sailed, I murdered William.
Have you ever noticed that pirates in the movies all seem to have the same distinctive way of speaking? Oh, you know what I mean, that guttural voice that sounds like they rubbed their vocal cords raw with sandpaper. You ever wonder why that is? Well, it could have something to do with this old instructional record came across in our music library.
Welcome to How to Speak Piratese. Lesson 1, The Basics. As a pirate, there's one particular word that you will use most often. Arrrr! Let's listen to it again. Then you try saying it. Arrrr! And now, here is your first pirate term. Run a rig! Now, let's hear it again. Then you try. Run a rig! Run a rig means to play a trick. Pirates often play practical jokes on each other to improve pirate morale. Now let's use this piratical phrase in a sentence.
How many times have I told ye not to run a rig on ye old captain? When I find out which one of ye scurvy dogs fed my parrot that laxative, I'll have ye keel-hauled. There be parrot poop all over me finest topcoat. Whoever be responsible will have to pay the martinizing bill.
Men. It's great to be on a ship with men and sail across the sea. Oh, we don't know where we'll land or when, but it's great to be with men.
It's great to be with men.
'Cause men can sweat and men can stink and no one seems to care. Oh, we'll throw the dishes in the sink and clog the drain with hair. Oh,
clog the drain with hair. Oh, men. It's a ship all filled with men. So batten down the ladies' room. There's no one here but men. Men.
There's men above, there's men below. There's men down in the galley. There's Butch.
And Spike.
And Buzz.
And one guy we call Sally.
And one guy we call Sally.
Men. It's a ship all filled with men. You'll never have to lift a seat. There's no one here but men.
Men. We're men and friends until the end, and none of us are sissies. At night we sleep in separate beds and blow each other kisses.
And blow each other kisses. Men. It's a ship all filled with men. So throw your rubbers overboard. There's no one here but men.
It's Martin Mull with Men, a song he wrote with Steve Martin.
Some people's hands are just useful for feeding themselves with. Other people's hands are rather more lethal.
Coming up, hunting modern-day pirates without using firearms. And we'll meet some female swashbucklers. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Piracy is still a major problem, and not just in the Caribbean. Jack Gottschalk is a practicing attorney. He's also one of the authors of a book called Jolly Roger with an Uzi, The Rise and Threat of Modern Piracy. As Gottschalk told Steve Paulson, the waters off Southeast Asia are among the most dangerous in the world.
Two major kinds of piracy occur in the Southeast Pacific. One, the old-fashioned kind of piracy that we're used to dealing with in terms of Henry Morgan and so forth, namely the rape, robbery, and murder, occurs to a frightening level with the boat people off Thailand, Vietnam, in that area. These people live on their boats, and there are no one knows how many people are raped, robbed, murdered in a course of a given year.
So there still are a lot of boat people. I mean, we heard about that, of course, at the end of the Vietnam War, yeah. But there are plenty of boat people.
Oh, sure. They've been there forever, and they will always be. And they are targets. And it's almost impossible to effectively police that area. The other thing you have to remember is some of the people in Southeast Asia, and in fact in the Caribbean, who are pirates, this has been a family thing. I mean, you have your day job, but at night you're a pirate. And this has been, you know, possibly for generations. And that's also, as I say, is particularly true in Southeast Asia. In the Philippines, for example, well, we know about that. Not only are there pirates, there are also guerrilla groups, which also act as pirates. So it's a double-edged problem.
What do you mean by guerrilla groups? You're talking about political groups.
The people who seized those individuals and held them captive. I mean, the rebel forces in these various areas, particularly in the Philippines, that they're fighting over there and have been for years, they often will act as pirates. They will seize ships, too, if they're near the coast.
Are there also more high-tech operations, people with high-powered automatic weapons who seize boats?
Well, when we get to the high-powered automatic weapons, any pirate can get a machine gun. If you've got enough money, you can get a machine gun. With the big ships, and this is a thing that's probably going to make the news at some point someday, The big ships in South China Sea, the Straits of Malacca, are targets. They're targets because they're large. They have small crews. People think that when they look at these huge tankers or dry cargo carriers, that they must have a whole bunch of people on board to make it run. And, of course, nothing could be further from the truth because of the fact that everything today is so computerized to run a ship. So they have a relatively small crew. Not only do they have a relatively small crew, if you have 20 people, they may speak 20 different languages. And they are not armed in any way. The unions do not want them to be armed. The ship owners don't want them to be armed either. So they're a sitting duck, if you will. And when they're moving through the water, at night particularly, can be hit by pirates, sometimes when the ship is moving as high as 18 or 19 knots, which is not a slow speed.
Why would the pirates want to hit these tankers?
Well, the biggest thing that they have, obviously, you're not going to steal the ship as they did in days of the buccaneers, at least in most cases you're not, although that has happened. But basically, you're going to get on there to do two things. You're going to want what's in the ship safe or safes, and you're going to want the money and whatever other valuables you can steal from the crew. So they get on, and once they're on, sometimes armed with guns, sometimes with hammers or iron pipes, and they overcome the crew. The first thing usually will happen is that the radio operator, particularly, is removed from his post, and the officers and the crew are either put onto a raft and sent out onto the ocean, or they're locked in a cabin, and the pirates will go through and pillage the ship. They will then leave, as has often been the case, and the ship is still moving through the water at 19 knots, but nobody's at the bridge, on the bridge. There have been some near misses with that, because unless the people can get out of the locked cabin, or if they're on a boat, on a raft, somehow let somebody else know that this thing is moving through the water by itself, the potential for a disaster is clear. There was one estimate that, because they had a couple of close calls with this, if you're another mariner and you see this thing coming, you have no idea that there's no one running it. They've been lucky so far, but there was one estimate that if one of these things, only one, happened in the narrow Straits of Malacca, and this was able to get into, let's say, sail into the port of Singapore, a collision with anything there would shut the port for up to 6 months.
Wow.
With all the relevant economic damage and ecological damage to the fish, and so on, particularly if it's a tanker.
So is there any good solution to the problem of modern piracy?
You're dealing with a $64,000 or $64 million question. I mean, this has come up even in with the U.S. Navy, which has apparently been given a greater role in dealing with this. But again, you've got to find the pirates. And the only way you're going to be able to really reduce this, and I say reduce because you're never going to eliminate it completely. The piracy during World War II in the Pacific, for example, virtually disappeared. The reason it disappeared was there were so many people floating around out there with guns. So it wasn't, you know, it was not a worthwhile risk.
I mean, basically, if you're willing to spend the money to patrol the ocean, then you're going to cut down on the level of piracy.
It's always been true. Going back to when piracy was first noted in the Mediterranean, piracy was rampant in the Mediterranean until Rome became a major naval power as well as a land power. When that occurred, piracy basically became a very minor incident. Also, it was a technological situation because in the early days of piracy, the pirate ships were just as formidable as the naval vessels. As those naval vessels began to outstrip the pirate vessels in terms of weight, tonnage, guns, and so forth, and speed, then, of course, that meant you wanted to take less of a risk if you were a pirate and going out and trying to catch one. That was one of the reasons in the early days why, if you'll see the old ships, the old sailing ships, very often they had what looked like gun ports painted on the sides because at a distance they looked much like a naval frigate, and pirates did not want to take on that particular enemy for obvious reasons.
Jack Gottschalk is one of the authors of the book Jolly Roger with an Uzi, The Rise and Threat of Modern Piracy. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
May bonny bunch of roses, oh, Go down, you blood-red roses. Go down.
We're plowed away to the ice and snow.
Go down, you blood-red roses. Go down.
Oh, you pinks and posers.
Go down, you blood-red roses. Go down,
me boots and clothes is all in port.
Captain John Dalby runs a company called Marine Risk Management, or MRM for short. The company repossesses ships when the ship's owners get behind on their payments. But 5 years ago, Marine Risk Management got into the pirate hunting business. Dalby told Steve Paulson how MRM tracks down pirates.
We invariably are able to get clues as to where the ship is, apart from the obvious logic progression where we know from our own experience where a ship is likely to go with a particular cargo. Having focused in and homed in on a particular area, we then have our own people on the ground looking out for it, asking questions. I know you don't expect me to go into too much detail about that, but we have a very good intelligence network.
You essentially have your spies on the ground who are tracking things.
Yeah, yeah. And when we don't have spies on the ground in a particular area, then we put them there.
And then once you actually have figured out which ship has been pirated, what do you do?
Well, we find it. We do an awful lot of reconnaissance and forward planning on this. It's not a sort of very fast 10-minute operation, go in, zap everybody and get out. We tread very carefully. It may be that wherever we physically find the ship, it's not appropriate for us to take any action, so we will put a tracking device on board, track it in real time, minute by minute almost, and then when it reaches an appropriate destination, which might even be on the high seas, then we'll go and recover our client's property for them.
What kind of a tracking device is this?
We have a device called ShipTrack, which is a satellite tracking device. It's a very, very small black box, if you like, that nobody knows is placed on board. It's completely self-reliant, doesn't require any outside power source, and could never be found by anybody on the ship.
What you're suggesting, then, is that your agents have figured out which ship has been stolen, and they somehow sneak this black box on board. And
that's right.
None of the pirates actually realize this has been done, and they have to do all of this by stealth. And then you're sort of tracking to see where the ship goes, and then you'll seize it later.
Yeah, that's right.
That sounds like tricky business.
It can be, especially for the guys that install the ship track in the first place.
How do they get on board with no one seeing them?
I didn't say they got on board without anybody seeing them. they get on board.
Can you explain a little bit?
Well, if a very little bit. if I put on an appropriate costume and a black beard and a pair of sunglasses, I could probably walk onto a particular ship in a particular area of the world and they might think I'm the ship's agent or one of the stevedores.
So it's a matter of disguise.
Or not. Well, in some cases, yeah, but in other cases, I mean, it is a very sort of stealthy operation, climbing on board in the middle of the night and just doing it under cover of darkness.
Okay, so once the ship has actually docked, then how do you seize it?
We don't, is the short answer. There are a number of problems with seizing a ship in dock, unless it's at the pirate's own facility, not least of which is the political problem with governments that are involved and their own authorities. So therefore, if a ship is in dock and we know that it's been pirated and obviously can persuade the local authorities, the local police or military, of the facts, then it has to be up to them to take the action that they deem appropriate. So we can't get involved in internal operations such as that. So our activities are almost always confined to the high seas.
So what, you board the other ship on the high seas and you force the pirates to give it up?
Yeah. Yeah, in a nutshell, that's exactly what we do. Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, we use techniques that have been well tried and tested by the US and UK Special Forces. We often use rigid inflatable dinghies, which I guess you're well familiar with, mm-hmm. With a group of guys on board. They will approach the pirated ship, again, usually and logically under cover of darkness, board it very stealthily and very quietly, and then do whatever's necessary to defuse the situation.
I read somewhere that you actually, that your people do this without weapons.
That's not strictly true. It depends on your definition of weapons. I mean, some people's hands are just useful for feeding themselves with. Other people's hands are rather more lethal. But we avoid wherever possible the use of lethal weapons. In other words, I'm not saying we don't carry them, but we avoid the use of firearms and so on.
You're talking about psychological warfare. You need to convince the pirates that they have no chance, they've got to give up.
Yeah, yeah. It's psychological, and to a certain extent it's an aggressive attitude towards them, far more aggressive than they ever could be. Because bearing in mind, again, if you're looking at Southeast Asia, and with all respect to Southeast Asians, they're generally somewhat smaller in stature than Europeans or Westerners. So there is an immediate advantage, an immediate size advantage. Plus the training and the way in which the guys present themselves can be quite frightening.
Give me an example of that. How do they present themselves?
Well, it's in the kind of outfits that they wear, all black, faces covered, funny little space hats on, and you get the picture. You've seen enough SEAL films and Special Forces films, and they're pretty close to the truth in terms of what the guys were, and their aggressive attitude is sort of second nature to them. They are having to get these pirates, who, you mustn't forget, have been taken by surprise, mm-hmm. unless we've really screwed up, which is has yet to happen, touch wood. So the appearance of these 6'3" guys garbed in black with just a bit of an eyeglass showing is pretty frightening.
I've read that the International Maritime Bureau doesn't approve of your work, even though you're catching criminals. Why would this or any other group object to what you're doing?
I don't know. A lot of the criticism we've had is because of the fact that we're a very proactive agency, if you like, and we act as opposed to just sit around talking and discussing and figuring out ways that the ships themselves can combat piracy, which is obviously a ridiculous nonsense. And the general consensus of opinion was that it should be left to governments to do, and that we've been called mercenaries, having a mercenary force take over a particular role is inappropriate or unsatisfactory in some way. On the other hand, we have people who are fully in support of it, obviously.
Captain John Dolby is the manager of Marine Risk Management. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, we'll meet Cheng Yi Sao and Grace O'Malley, girl pirates on the high seas, and we'll surf the internet to explore digital piracy and find out why the record industry may have missed the boat when it comes to online music distribution.
College kids are their biggest market, certainly the ones that set the pace for the rest of the culture. And they were embracing the internet and embracing music through the internet, while the record industry seemed to be doing everything they can to stop that. Instead of riding this wave, they tried to stop the wave, and, you know, it's very difficult to stop a wave.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Sarah Lorimer is the author of Booty, Girl Pirates on the High Seas. In her book, she tells the true tales of some women buccaneers who did their fair share of pillaging and plundering, like Cheng Yi Sao. Back in the early 1800s, Cheng Yi Sao ran a virtual pirate empire in the South China Sea.
She had some 80,000 pirates working for her. Men, women, and children, entire families would be on these ships.
Boy, it doesn't sound like pirates anymore, does it? It sounds like a small government.
Sort of, in a way. She definitely was leading these people. She united warring pirate gangs. It was very political. But they were pirates. They were committing crimes on the water.
Now, how did she get into this?
She was originally working in a brothel and was maybe abducted or somehow met Cheng Yi or Cheng Ai, sorry, I don't know how to pronounce his name, who was a pirate at the time. And he convinced her to marry him. She agreed to it so long as she could be his equal. So the two of them actually worked to unite all the warring pirate gangs. Then he died, perhaps in a storm, and she took over the family business.
Was there any question about this at the time? I mean, did the pirates under their command say, no, we don't want to work for a woman?
I don't know. She was very fierce. She came to this one meeting that they had where they were, I presume, going to organize, you know, or figure out how things were going to be run. She came wearing her husband's battle helmet, you know, carrying a sword. She was very fierce, very beautiful, and somehow she convinced them to see things her way.
And she was a real pirate. I mean, she engaged in acts of piracy, including storming other ships and things.
She was a real pirate. Some of the pirate women in my book were more leaders, but this woman was actually out there, sword in hand, killing people. Yep, she was a pirate.
What kind of things did they do?
They attacked fishing boats and cargo ships, and then they even attacked coastal villages and military garrisons. They held people captive. They ran a protection scheme.
They ran a protection scheme? What was
that
like?
They ran a protection scheme. They would, much like you hear of protection now, perhaps, with the mafia, if you bought a certificate of protection from the pirates, they would guarantee your ship's free passage.
So you had a piece of paper that said...
You had an actual certificate that said, you are allowed to, you know, go through these waters, your ships, your salt ships or your other cargo ships are allowed to go through here, and we will not attack you, and we will keep you safe from other pirates.
Wow. And she had 80,000 at one point working for her. That's mm-hmm. got to be at least one of the largest pirate fleets ever, doesn't it?
I think it was the largest. It was actually six different fleets, and I believe it was the largest collection of pirates ever.
There are some others, many others, that you write about. There's a pair of female pirates from the 1700s, Mary Read and Anne Bonny. Can you tell me about them?
Sure. They're probably the most famous pirates, or women pirates, just because they were active at the time of the peak of piracy. When we think of pirates, you know, we think of parrots and coats, you know, with all the lace and the trimmings and mm-hmm. yo-ho-ho and all that sort of thing. That's when these two were active. Mary was English. She had been raised as a boy. Although her mother knew that she was a girl, she'd been raised as her brother for complicated reasons and had ended up in the Caribbean on a privateer. And Anne Bonny was raised in colonial America and eloped with a pirate and then ran away with another pirate. And they ended up on the same ship with Mary dressed as a man. Anne made a pass at Mary, and that's how she discovered that she was another woman on this same ship. And the two of them had a short career around Jamaica and Cuba.
What kind of piracy did they engage in?
Their crimes were not quite as interesting, perhaps, as some others. They attacked fishing boats. Their plunder was rather small. They just attack small boats, get the fish, the rigging, the food, those sorts of things.
And did Mary Read and Anne Bonny engage in the piracy themselves? I mean, were they carrying swords and pistols and attacking boats?
They were carrying swords and pistols. They were threatening people. They were out there fully being piratical.
Now, and at one time, they were both in disguise as men on board ship, which seems really difficult when you think about it, with such close quarters and all of that, but they somehow managed to pull that off. What did the other pirates think of them?
Well, there's always some question about this. My guess is that Mary Read actually pulled it off and people thought she was a man. According to the biographies written of her shortly after her death, she managed to do this her entire life, except for the two times when she got married. Anne Bonny, it seems, maybe the other pirates on the ship were going along with it, saying, oh, sure, she's a man. Mm-hmm.
Were they treated
differently by the world at large than their male counterparts were?
They had a separate trial. Their entire ship was caught by the English, and their trial was held separately from their male crewmates. But they were also found guilty and sentenced to be hanged. At their trial, they both claimed to be pregnant, and so there was a delay while that matter could be researched, I suppose, during which Mary Read died of fever in prison, and Anne Bonny disappeared. It's not known what happened to her.
So it's possible that she may have gotten away.
She may have gotten away. She may have died in prison.
Now, there is an Irish pirate, Grace O'Malley, you call her. She was definitely in charge as well, right?
Yes, she was the captain of her pirate crew and of her ship. She would have been a chieftain on land, except at the time women could not be chieftains. This is in Ireland, on the west coast of Ireland. She was active from around 1550 to 1600 as a pirate.
Where did she come from? How did she get started in this?
A family tradition of piracy. When she was a teenager, her father taught her how to sail, and her family had another bit of a protection scheme running that was a popular thing for these pirates.
Grace O'Malley was taught by her father to sail. She then went off and married a clan chieftain, is that right?
Yes, that's right. And after he died, that's when she became sort of the acting chieftain of his clan, which included pillaging at sea and on land.
Grace O'Malley is interesting for a lot of reasons, I guess, because she actually fought off the government, not at sea, but at home, right?
Yeah, she actually was granted a royal audience with Queen Elizabeth, which was very rare for chieftains, especially women chieftains. And Queen Elizabeth seems to have had some sympathy for her arguments. Grace O'Malley was asking her to call off the government forces that were making it difficult for her to earn a living, as she thought of it. And Queen Elizabeth heard her and agreed and had her men back off a bit.
One of the other interesting things I think about a number of these is how many of these women pirates seem to have married and raised families, as it were.
Sometimes at sea, legend has it that Grace O'Malley gave birth to her fourth child during a battle. And at one point, she's below decks in labor, and one of her crewmen came down to say, you know, help, we're losing the battle. And she actually came up and yelled at them all, just cursing them for not being able to get by without her for a single day.
Sarah Lorimer is the author of Booty, Girl Pirates on the High Seas. And now here's a part of a song about the Irish pirate, Grace O'Malley.
What can you see from the mastheads? Spanish ships are fishing. What can you see from the masthead? A Portuguese from Newfoundland. Rising up on the breaking wave, let her carry you over all the sea in the morning. Way, hey, and up she rises. The sun is up, the birds are winging, we're sailing free and easy.
When the ship runs out of ocean and the vessel runs aground, lands where we know the boat is found. Now there's nothing unexpected but the water giving out. Land's not a word we have to shout, but there's something beside the shoreline, moving across the beach head, coming up from the shipwreck, making as if to say, women and men, women and men.
That's They Might Be Giants. The duo has used the internet to their advantage. A few years ago, the band released an album that was available only on the internet. The record industry as a whole hasn't been nearly as successful at figuring out how to take advantage of distributing their product online. The industry's been fighting a tough battle against digital piracy. John Alderman is the author of the book Sonic Boom, Napster, MP3, and the New Pioneers of Music. Alderman told Steve Paulson how online music distribution started.
You could say that it started with music and internet enthusiasts, you know, sort of nerdy people who wanted to get on and talk with other people who were interested in the internet, and they discovered that they could send files from one person to the other, and it was a good way of reaching out to other people with the same interests and sharing stuff. But the problem was it was very difficult because those were very big files, usually, the music files. And the connections were often very slow. So when someone had the bright idea to use an encoding scheme like MP3, what that did was it took those large files and it threw out a lot of the extraneous data that most people wouldn't hear anyways. And so it made them much smaller and much more easy to distribute over the net.
Can you explain what MP3s are, how the technology works?
Sure. Well, what it is an algorithm, a mathematical formula that, you know, and a very big and complex one that takes a piece of music that's been digitally encoded and it analyzes that piece of music and it pulls out all the extra bits of information that people won't hear. So what it does is it shrinks a file down to make it more manageable to send it over the internet.
So explain how Napster really revolutionized this technology.
Well, before Napster, you had a bunch of just enthusiasts sharing music with each other and sort of putting up a piece of music, or they would have a website that they would offer, you know, whatever they wanted to put on there, but next week it would be gone. So a young man named Sean Fanning, who was a university student in Massachusetts, had the bright idea that he could write a program that would search the hard drive of anyone who was running it, and it would identify all the music that was on there, and then it would send the names of all those songs to a central database that was constantly dynamically updated. And so anyone who was running the program could see what anyone else was offering at any given moment. So it was a very fast, very efficient way of finding what was out there. And as it grew, because people got very excited about it, suddenly the network got very large, and there was almost anything that you could want on there. Songs that were out of print, lots of live versions of songs that people couldn't find elsewhere, as well as stuff that you couldn't get at your record store.
Now, you can see why record companies would not like this technology, because people suddenly had access to all kinds of music without actually going out and buying the albums. And the industry went to court to shut down Napster, and they were successful. What has happened since then? How is this technology being used?
Well, what's happened since Napster's off the scene is that many different competitors to Napster have arisen and people are using them. And it's very easy to use one of these competitors and find a very popular piece of music. You can go out and get, you know, an Eminem recording. But because the group of users is much smaller, it's a lot harder to find more interesting pieces of music or rarer pieces of music. So it's not nearly as exciting as it was when there's this massive network of people. And you also see the record industry, because it's sued all of these companies, you know, it's reduced their worth a great deal. They're able to spend a little bit of money and acquire most of the competitors that they had. You know, one of the big five record labels owns MP3.com, which was a huge company at one time, owns Napster, although it's sort of gutted, but they own the rights to Napster, and many others. So, you know, early on, I talked to Ice-T, the rapper and actor Ice-T, and his whole idea was that the music industry was using gangster tactics, and what he meant was that if people didn't play by their game, they would attack them, and then they, you know, weaken them so that they would come back the next day and say, oh, you know, you're going to play by my rules, and they would have no other choice but to play along. And, you know, you might expect that Ice-T would use that analogy, but really it's turned out to be the case.
What you're really saying is that there is this incredible technology out there that could be tapped, and this is a very exciting time in terms of how people can listen to music, but the infrastructure is not there right now.
Right. Well, if you look at Napster as a proof of concept, you had a very amazing success because you had this quick program that was put up, didn't offer a lot of frills, but it was convincing enough that after a few months, millions of people were using it. It was one of the most successful things in the history of the internet. And if they can figure out a way to build a system that provides that with a few more frills and makes it worthwhile for people to pay for, you know, people who use computers, for the most part, they've shelled out $2,000 for their computer, and they're probably paying, you know, $50 a month for their cable bill. So, you know, there's money to be spent. And I think people have, almost everyone wants to feel that they're rewarding artists for giving them pleasure and making interesting stuff. So it's just a question of getting it right. And, you know, it may just be that right now we're in a period when everyone's trying out, you know, their vision, and after a year or two, the best one will emerge. And I hope that's the case, or the best several will emerge.
So what's the solution to this problem?
Well, I think the solution is figuring out a way of rewarding people. One possible solution, I think it's probable that it'll work out to something like this, is a subscription model, something like they have, but that gives consumers a little more, gives them the ability to, you know, if you know that you're going to get something that you want whenever you go on, then you'll be convinced that it's worthwhile to pay that $9.95 a month or whatever it is. And if the contracts that that service has with the artists are such that they're feeling rewarded, then I think everyone's happy. What it'll take to get there, you know, it might take a lot. It might take a lot of renegotiation of skills. But I think one thing that it requires is vision. And unfortunately, you know, for the record industry to, you know, so far its vision has been a legal one. You know, you had Edgar Bronfman, who was the chief of Universal Music. He came to San Jose and he said he was going to depopulate Silicon Valley with a Roman legion of Wall Street lawyers. He said he was going to take the, you know, in order to respect copyright, he would have to destroy the internet in order to save it. And he was willing to do that. You know, that's not a healthy vision. You know, that's sad legal bluster. And, you know, that's not about progress, you know, because what you have is you have a big change. You have a shift from music being tied to a physical object to music that is not tied to an object and can be replicated at will. And, you know, it's a totally different environment. And, you know, they're trying all sorts of legal solutions to force the new reality to conform with the rules of the old. And I don't think that can be successful. And even if it can, it'll be successful at the cost of the new technology, and, you know, I just don't think turning progress back is a good idea for anyone.
John Alderman is the author of Sonic Boom, Napster, MP3, and the New Pioneers of Music. We spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a cassette copy of this hour, please call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program It's a Plunderful Life, number 818A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering assistance by Marv Nunn and music assistance from Judy Rose.
PRI, Public Radio International.